Extra Points is presented for the people by Caesars Sportsbook, the greatest sports betting app of all time. Download it. It must be 21 years or older.
Welcome, Extra Points listeners, and congratulations on making it through yet another week. Good news, the weekend awaits with its enchanting promises of endless sports and free time that ends up with you screaming silently at some jerk in the Costco parking lot instead. Or maybe I'm just projecting. Either way, we know how hard you work, and while we hope listening to all our shows makes that time go a little faster, we don't want that to feel like work in and of itself. So we've had our producers pick out their favorite bits and put them together in a half-hour supercut for you to sample. I know, I can't believe we have producers either. If you like something, check out the full episode the next week wherever you get your podcasts. In the meantime, thanks for supporting the network. And let me just say from the bottom of my heart as the co-founder that I sincerely hope your favorite team still loses to mine. Enjoy the shows.
And to start off this best of on Lemon Pepper Parlay, Martin Weiss and Mark Gunnels talk about head coach John Calipari leaving the Kentucky Wildcats for SEC rival the Arkansas Razorbacks.
Let's take 1 second and talk about the big news in men's college basketball that was not related to the national championship game, because secretly the man hasn't sniffed the national championship game in quite some time. John Calipari, who I've long since said he's got an eye for talent, but coaching could be a little, he could do a little better there, but guys put more guys in the NBA than a lot of different schools have over the last 15 years, especially when you consider the number one overall picks in the, and I should say you just even the lottery picks. And it seems to me that some of my favorite players in the league all have one thing in common. They are guards from Kentucky, because those guys are stone cold killers. And I guess we'll see if he can continue recruiting stone cold killer guards at Arkansas.
Yeah, I think he absolutely will. I mean, when you're a brand like Calipari, we mentioned earlier, these college coaches in basketball and football, they're brands within themselves. So wherever he goes, I mean, he could have went to freaking Rhode Island or Maine, and he would have brought some high-level recruits there. I mean, for instance, I just looked earlier today. Did you know that the 2024 recruiting class, two players in the top 10 are going to Rutgers? I don't even know who the head coach at Rutgers is, so excuse me for that.
Ron Harper Jr. is one of them, right?
Okay. Yeah, I believe so. Yes, yes. So, you know, I don't think it really matters too much the name on the front anymore, especially with the NIL.
No, what it matters is the money in the back pocket. That's what matters.
Yeah, exactly. So he's going to flip a lot of guys that are already committed to Kentucky. They're going to follow him to Arkansas. We know how this game goes. It's going to be fascinating, the fact that he stayed in conference, too. So we're going to get that return game to Lexington, where I don't think he's going to be greeted too well there, because I've heard a lot of fans have kind of just outgrown him. Eddie was telling me before we got on air that a lot of them just didn't like him anymore, right? Because they're used to winning. And we had this conversation before. Like, you can't – it's hard to fire a guy like that, because he brings so much talent there. You know, he's good for the alumni base, you know, got guys going to the league and stuff like that. But the fans there, they care about their program actually winning. Like, of course, they want to see their guys go to the NBA and do well, but they want winning on top of all of that as well. And that hasn't been the case. He's only won one tournament game, one single tournament game in the last 4 years.
That's pretty incredible. Honestly, that's pretty, like, you would think that, you know, but I think that he's going to be at a crossroads in his career, but I think he'll be able to recruit and keep guys at Arkansas a little bit better than he would at a Kentucky, because he's going to have to be forced to go. He'll have his one and dones. There's no doubt about it. But I think the base of the program, like, he's not going to be able to pull in 6 5-star recruits at a school like Arkansas. And the way that I've always looked at college basketball is like the way that John Beilein did it, honestly, at Michigan. He built a foundation of 3-star guys, added a 3-star guy with pop like Trey Burke, And then he started getting like 1 4-5 star, 2 4-5 stars. And then, but he still always had the foundation, the base of the roster was the glue guys, the guys that fit into the mold. And those guys are generally going to be 3 and 4 star guys, not necessarily your blue chip top recruits, right? You got to have somebody to go rebound. You got to have somebody to go play defense. You got to have, now your bucket getter, that guy, go ahead, sign up the number one guy in the country to go do that. But if you sign up the number 2, 3, 4 guy in the country, you just got 4 bucket getters and nobody to do all the extra stuff that actually wins your basketball games.
And so I just looked it up on ESPN.com, their top 100 for this upcoming class, just for reference of guys who are probably going to follow him to Arkansas. Kentucky has 5 guys in the top 100. 2 of those guys are 5 stars, and one of those 5 stars is, you bet it, a point guard.
I mean, that's a good place to have a 5-star at. But, you know, and also, too, it seems like, and this happens to a lot of, I think, college coaches as they, I don't want to say overstay their welcome, but, like, as they wear and wear on the fan base, right? Because, you know, like you said, those March results are generally what people in Kentucky care about. And you see all of a sudden now he can't really – They restrict who they want to hire as his assistants, right? And maybe, you know, I think I talk about it all the time in the NFL. It's true for all sports, though. Part of being a great head coach is being able to knowing who to hire and who to fire as your assistant coaches, right? Knowing who to bring in, knowing where you lack, and bringing your assistant coaches in to boost, right? And I know that when Kenny Payne went to Louisville, a lot of what made Kentucky good went with him. Now, Louisville was absolutely terrible with Kenny Payne as the head coach, but as a result, he's incredibly available right now. I wouldn't be surprised to see him join Cal down in Arkansas now that he's got, you know, his buddy John Tyson, the heir of Tyson Foods. If you ever had made chicken nuggets, you're familiar with Tyson Foods, but they got, you know, million. He's a billionaire. So the war chest is open. Jerry Jones is out there. So you know what? Woo pig suey for the Arkansas Razorbacks, because they said, you know what? Forget football. That's too hard. We'll do basketball. And I think they'll give him the money to hire the coaches that he wants. And I think as a result of that, you know, if there's one thing we've known about John Calipari, he's great at amassing talent.
On the Kentucky side, real quick, who's your number one target?
First, I'd probably call Danny Hurley with a blank check and say, how would you like to come coach here? And then I would probably call Jay Wright.
That's my guy right there, Jay Wright.
And I think they eventually probably land on a Scott Drew.
Okay. Yeah, that's all good options. Yeah, Jay Wright was my number one guy. He's been retired for 2 years. Kind of retired abruptly, like people were pretty surprised, right? Because he's still fairly young, right? He's only 62 years old. It's not that old for a college basketball head coach. At Villanova, he won 2 national championships, went to 4 Final Fours, and they were kind of like in that UConn territory, like, where are they the new blue blood?
Don't you say it.
So, like, I think, you know, he's been doing TV the last couple of years, took some time off. Kentucky comes calling. I wouldn't be surprised if Jay Wright entertains that.
I would not be surprised one bit either. And I think that actually has a great shot. But I think that one of the things that Jay Wright did retire off of, you remember those, Jalen Brunson was relatively old for college basketball. Dante, they were old players. They stayed at Villanova and came back after having success in the tournament and so on and so forth. I think that has a lot to do with why Jay Wright was like, you know what, I'm hanging it up because of the changing landscape of college basketball. I think that had something to do with it. And that landscape now is all the way changed, right? Yeah. So I think that Jay Wright's like, yo, I can make just as much money sitting on TV and nobody's going to talk about how much I won or lost. And instead, I'll do the talking about winning and losing. So that's what makes me think that Jay Wright might be out of touch. And if I'm Danny Hurley, I'm like, why the hell would I leave UConn? I'm balling right now. I was like, now, and I bet if I'm UConn, especially on the men's side of things, you know, this is what we do here, right? We don't do football. We don't do baseball. We do basketball. I would offer the same, like, as much as Kentucky will come with a blank check. One thing is definitely true. Dan Hurley's getting a raise at the end of the season, right? And I feel like that's one thing that college basketball coaches had to see when Calipari left. They're like, yes. The same way, like, when Saban retired, it's like, yes, we're all going to get a raise now. All we got to do is say, we're linked to this job. And then, boom, all of a sudden, right, you know, here it goes. Exactly. One thing I do think, I don't think that Nate Oates would do well at Kentucky. If I'm Nate Oates, I'm staying in Alabama.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, he would be like probably fourth or fifth on my list behind the three names that we already mentioned, Jay Wright, Hurley, and
Scott Drew. That's who I think will eventually get the job.
Yeah, he seems the most likely. He seems like most likely for sure.
It's a natural step up from Baylor. You know, he's had success in both conference and March Madness tournaments.
Got a championship.
Which qualifies as success, right? So he's had success there. And that's it. I mean, if you can get guys to move to Waco, Texas, you can get guys to live in Lexington, Kentucky. So I think it'll be fine over there.
Tommy John is a name you don't want to hear on an MLB clubhouse. Myself, Dave Damashek, and Kevin Hench on -3 talking about the insane amount of elbow injuries happening around baseball. Major League Baseball has, you know, the gambling controversy going on with Ohtani. You have the uniform, the Fanatics crisis. You have rule changes. You have nobody watching on television. And like the hits just keep coming. And now it seems like every top pitcher
in Pittsburgh, the hits keep coming. Let's go, Buckos.
All of our teams is playing pretty well. But every top pitcher is going to now have to go through some sort of elbow injury, elbow surgery. You have Shane Bieber, Spencer Strider, obviously Gerrit Cole, probably avoiding Tommy John surgery, hopefully back in a month or so, but he's missing some time. Jonathan Loaisiga on the Yankees, not as fortunate. He has a UCL injury. He's going to be gone. You had the Miami Marlins, their top pitching prospect, Yuri Perez. He has to have the surgery after their Cy Young winner 2 years ago, Sandy Alcantara had it. And like, what is the fix here when you have these pitchers in this kind of like spring training schedule where they're barely pitching? Like the Yankees, their pitcher Gill in his first career start, like winning the game, they took him out before the fifth inning, so he couldn't even get the registered win because you're less than the five inning mark. And like, if your pitcher in the first 2 months or so of the season goes six innings, you're like pleasantly surprised. You're shocked almost they're going this far. This is not back in the days where you have like, you know, Fernando Valenzuela going like, what is it, like 13, 14 innings, or guys pitching back to back starts. Like, that is a thing of the past. So like, what is going wrong when they're babying pitchers in Major League Baseball? And I think the problem really is these guys now and just parents and coaches when you're young are overtraining, because your arm is not coming into the league as a 21-year-old arm. It's coming in at like a 30-year-old arm, because you're throwing, like, once you hit the high school age range, you're doing travel teams, high school, college teams. You're basically playing all year round. Baseball is no longer just a sport in one season. You're playing 365 days a year. And I think like there's going to have to be some, I don't know what they could fix, because and Little League does a good job of rules where you have pitch counts, you can't throw breaking balls. But this is clearly an issue like that's happening across the league because of starting in the youth like game, where it's just absolutely destroying your shoulder and your elbow. And like, so
Verlander weighed in on it on Monday morning or maybe on Sunday. Hench, did you? He said like, oh, some of it, there's some thought that it's the pitch clock's fault. I don't know if you heard that one, Spaghetti, yeah. But.
Yeah, but I don't understand. So the extra 10 seconds is going to heal your elbow on the mound? I don't agree with that.
The five-man rotation, you need more rest. You need more rest between pitches. That seems insane. But the point is, Major League pitchers have never been coddled the way they are now, and we've never had as many catastrophic injuries.
Exactly.
So given how coddled they are now, obviously something is happening prior to arriving in the big leagues. And I mean, I know, you know, maybe there's just so many bullets in the belt, and these kids on travel teams, you know, like you are, you know, kids throwing breaking balls. You would much rather, I think, have a 16-year-old who played center field, who has a great arm, but hasn't thrown 100,000 game pitches.
Yeah, I guess don't be a pitcher. Yeah, if you're a parent, don't let him be a pitcher. Don't let him be a running back. Those are not premium positions, both for their health and while the wallet's good to be a starting pitcher. But yeah, it's as simple as the breaking balls, right? It's that, like, why did Bob Feller or, you know, guys who would throw 250 innings, why doesn't that exist anymore? It's because of the nature of the breaking balls they're throwing now, right, Hench?
I mean, when you see the screwball particularly, which you don't see much of anymore, but, like, you know, they would do those super slow-mo on the arm, like the elbow is doing. You're like, well, that can't last. Like, yeah, that thing's going to fall off, you know? So it is weird, though. I think they need to go to the all-star game rule of this 5 innings for a win thing is crazy. When 5 innings, you know, when a guy's at 80 pitches, you're like, oh, he's never going to get through 5. So a guy throws 4 2/3. This is my rotisserie complaint. Guy throws 4 2/3. Other guy comes in, throws 3 pitches to get the 15th out. He gets the win. Mm-hmm. So insane. I mean, it used to make sense because unless he got shelled, your guy was definitely going 5 innings. And now it's like they just, the whole approach is don't go 3 times through the order. So, you know, it's just harder and harder for starters to get wins. You have all those middle inning vultures.
It's like, you know, when we talk about NFL games, when it's like a big play happening and you brace yourself to not see that yellow flag come on the screen. That's basically how it is now when your top guy goes and he pitches and you're like, can he last the season? And not only is that the problem, I think also, too, is like we talk about this, like Saquon Barkley, like the guys who are just so in shape and they're constantly working out their bodies. I do think the over training again at a young age and even as a professional, I think also hurts the arm. But like we're now going to have to switch the criteria for starting pitchers in the Hall of Fame, because it used to be like, oh, if you won 300 games, like you're in this like upper echelon, like we're not even going to sniff 300 games, let alone 200 games for a good starter now. So like what is going to, and like the pitchers could barely go the 5 innings. So like, I don't know what going forward, like, I don't even know what you're going to see, like, or who you're going to see enter, you know, Cooperstown, because the pitching statistics are going to look vastly different from even less than 20 years ago.
That was, you know, when we did the, you know, records that will never be broken. We had a lot of good stuff from our listeners, obviously. And, you know, Denny McClain winning 30 games, obviously, don't have to worry about that. Mm-hmm. But like, even as kids, Cy Young winning 511 games was ridiculous. Even when, you know, there was 4-man rotation, you're like, well, no one's coming near that. It's like no pitcher starting now is going to come within 300 wins of Cy Young. Like, there won't be a 211 game winner in the big leagues in the rest of Spaghetti's lifetime.
It is weird too. It's kind of where we started an hour ago. It kind of is like, what's the most unsatisfying, like, kind of gut punch you could take as a sports fan? It's, oh, we're not going to get a final shot. The referee blew the whistle, and so the game's over now. Instead of like seeing the player decide it, I think worse than that. Well, certainly worse than that is like just hearing the day off. Like, oh, our stud pitcher has elbow discomfort. Like, oh no, oh no. Two years now lost. You just in that moment, you know, like, yeah, oh my god, we're not going to see him be relevant for 2.5 years from now is the worst. I'm waiting for it on Paul Skeens, believe me.
Let's take a quick break here.
You know, when the conversation turns tampers, I always go with my number one as Caesars. Let's talk about them a little bit, shall we? Tickets to the game, merch, meals at iconic restaurants, stays at Caesars Palace. All this can be yours when you bet with Caesars Sportsbook. Win or lose, every bet earns rewards credits, which you can redeem across the empire. Now, if you haven't started yet, register using this code. Listen up. OmahaFull. The word Omaha and the word full. And then you place your first bet up to $1,250. If you win, great. If you keep those winnings, but if you lose, you'll get your stake back as a bonus bet. 21 and over only. Offer valid and must be physically present in Arizona, Colorado, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Louisiana, Massachusetts, Maryland, Michigan, New Jersey, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia, and Wyoming. New users and first $10 plus wager only. Must register with eligible promo code. Bet amount of qualifying wager returned only if wager is settled as a loss. Maximum bonus bet, $1,250. Bonus bet expires 14 days after receipt. Tier credits and reward credits will be added to account within 7 days after qualifying wager settles. See Caesars.com/promos for full terms. Void where prohibited. Know when to stop before you start. Gambling problem? Arizona, call 1-800-NEXT-STEP. Colorado, Wyoming, Kansas, affiliated with Kansas Crossing Casino, call 1-800-522-4700. Indiana, call 1-800-9-WITH-IT. Iowa, call 1-800-BETS-OFF. Louisiana, call 1-877-770-STOP. Licensed through Horseshoe, Bossier City, and Harrah's, New Orleans. Massachusetts, call 1-800-327-5050 or visit gamblinghelplinema.org. Michigan, call 1-800-270-7117. Illinois, Maryland, New Jersey, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia, Ohio, Pennsylvania, affiliated with Harrah's, Philadelphia. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem, crisis counseling and referral services can be accessed by calling 1-800-GAMBLER or West Virginia, 1-800-GAMBLER.net. New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369.
Now, let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom! Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good! The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Hi, this is ESPN's Mike Greenberg, and ESPN Bet is ready to take you through all the biggest sports moments this spring. The official sports book of ESPN has exclusive offers and markets from Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, and me. From the playoff intensity to finally getting out to the ballpark, there's no better time for sports fans. Sign up today, and new users get $100 in bonus bets for making any sports book bet. Download ESPN Bet today. What a play.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply. See app for details.
With the solar eclipse this week, a lot of people went outside to look up into the sky, while some people didn't change their routine at all. During the episode of Trinity, Toby Mergler and Brett Corominas talk about their sports solar eclipse, aka stuff that everyone else tunes into, but they don't.
All right, well, my take is not anywhere near the level of yours with the vitriol, the scar tissue, and the intensity, or none of those things. I'm just not into cars. Like, my eclipse is like anything driving related, NASCAR, F1, anything. I'm just not here for it. Like, if I want to watch cool driving, Keanu Reeves needs to evolve. I need to be watching John Wick try to escape something or smash into bad guys. Like, I do not care about anything that is driving related. I can't speak to it. I don't get it. I get like the live aspect of it because it's fun to drink during the day, literally at anything where that's socially acceptable. So like, I get going to a race, but like watching it on TV, it's like 4 hours of left turns. I'm out.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you on that one. I mean, I love movies like Baby Driver and Ryan Gosling's Drive, and like, I think there, even that stretch, like there's the big chase scene and like the Tom Cruise like reboot of Jack Reacher was pretty good. I'm here for like cool movie car chases. I mean, the Baby Driver was like such a fun movie. It's like a cool, fun soundtrack. It was like interesting premise and cool car chases, and they shot the movie in a really different way. But if you're gonna be like, yeah, this guy's spoiler is like a tenth of degree lower and it gives him like this and it makes his car faster and means he doesn't have to pit like this, like, I respect people that have their passions and they love that kind of stuff and they love the nuances of NASCAR. It is not for me at all.
Well, I mean, we agree on it, but like, I'm not trying to like yuck everybody's yum. It's just like, same with the eclipse. I'm glad people take vacation that are like super into it. It's just, I'm just not going to be one of them. But like, I've been on the other side of this, and you probably have been too, like, especially as soccer fans. Like, there's a lot of time as a soccer fan in America where I was like on the other side. It's like, people just want to tell me about the diving and, you know, things like that, and how there's not enough goals and how much it sucks. Like, okay. So the other side of like the eclipse thing is like, The 2008 Champions League final, Chelsea versus Manchester United in the rain at Moscow. I was working at a law firm at the time as a lawyer. I was a young associate, and I had this like circled on my calendar. And let me tell you, like, the first wild thing about that day, Brett, it was a Wednesday. Like, the Champions League final was on a Wednesday. Like, can you imagine the funny Super Bowl was just in the middle of the week? Why was this a thing? I don't understand it. It's like, oh, well, we can't interrupt the domestic leagues. Like, they don't reschedule the Super Bowl because of the XFL. Like, you're the freaking Champions League. Like, take your position on Sunday.
I didn't know that. That's funny.
So like it was a work day, and it's like obviously with the time change, it was like 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and like this is before NBC got the Premier League, so there wasn't anywhere near as many people that was watching international soccer, but Chelsea was in the Champions League, and so I went to like. I was in downtown DC. I went to a bar that has international flags out front. Like DC is actually a great place for soccer. It always has been because of that element of it. And I went in, even in this place that is like a very known for like having you know, international flags and all that kind of stuff. Nobody is watching it. It is just me. It is an eclipse for one. And then I have to go and watch the most painful Chelsea loss, like probably of my lifetime to this day. In the penalty kick, and when Terry missed the penalty kick for them to fail to win it, I guess they lost it in the next round. I flipped a table over and started screaming and walked out. And in that moment, I was the crazy person. I was the crazy person who cared the most about the thing going on around me, and nobody else cared at all. You got anything like that?
Not mine. Oh, you mean this is going to be shocking to you? You know me well enough. Mine isn't about a specific event like that. So, I mean, there are probably some sporting events that I've really cared about, mostly like random stuff I probably bet on.
Yeah, of course.
Or just things with like a player that we worked with where like I was really excited about a game he had or something like that. But my biggest general thing that I know that I'm the crazy person about like you were for that Champions League game is Mike D'Antoni's legacy. I am, and this is in full disclosure, like he looked after me a lot during my career in basketball. He's a good dude. So part of it is like who he is as a person. But I also get so mad, and I've written about him multiple times. I just actually recently wrote about him for True Hoop over the summer. And he gets looked at like he was this ideologue that had one good idea, and that was the 7 seconds or less Suns. Like he created this team that played pick and roll and played small and shot all these threes, and like that was his one contribution to basketball. And so he kind of, if for you and I, like the soccer people, he kind of gets compared to like Arsene Wenger, right? Like he found this one thing that they did, and then that one idea everybody copied, and then he was kind of rendered obsolete by it. That could be the furthest thing from the truth. He has literally influenced every single type of tactical thing that we see in basketball at this point, not only the pace, not only the three-point shooting, not only the downshifting to playing skilled players over just lumbering big men. But then when he moved from Phoenix to the Knicks, he utilized David Lee as basically a point guard in the trail. So when you see Jokic and when you see Bam Adebayo like catch the ball after they come down the court and get into dribble handoffs and make all these crazy passes, you know who started utilizing big guys like that? Mike D'Antoni. And then when he went to Houston, you know, this heliocentric model that everybody talks about, like Doncic ball or Russell Westbrook's usage rate or whatever it was that came up. You know who started that? Who had the trend of being like, I have one guy on my team that is, I would rather see him face a set defense or break down switches the entire game than like let Trevor Ariza come off a DHO. Was Mike with James Harden in Houston. That was the start of heliocentric basketball, where he was like, I'm going to give my best player the most possessions, way above everybody else. I don't care if they know what's coming, because him with the ball in his hands is better than anybody else in that team doing anything. And you know what they did? They pushed a Golden State Warriors team at the peak of their prime with 4 Hall of Famers to Game 7 without Chris Paul. So sure. I am always going to be a huge fan of his legacy. He has impacted everything that you enjoy about the NBA and how it's played and all the fun stuff that's going on. Mike had a hand in that, and he never gets credit for it, and he gets cast out as an ideologue, and I am a psychopath that will argue with the random egg on Twitter, although I don't think those exist anymore. Now it's just Russian bots. But I will argue with anybody who says otherwise. I am the biggest Mike D'Antoni stan. I care about his legacy probably, definitely more than he does, but it's my thing. It's my eclipse.
All right. Well, I will save myself from your eclipse by telling you how I think he helped ruin basketball with that heliocentricity, but that's not his fault. He just he had to deal with what he had to do to try to take down the Warriors, but I don't think it's been particularly good for basketball.
So I don't think it's been good, but I'm saying
I'm out on that.
It exploited. I mean, it's definitely a more efficient style to play. And he even said, like, I don't like playing this way, but it's the, like, I used to call it brute force offense. It's the most efficient way to score now, right? Space all your guys out, let them all shoot threes, let your best player just break down and play a little bit of one-on-one. That's just how the rules have shifted basketball. So, which is another thing, that would be another thing. Can you please ban the charge and put defensive 3 seconds and make that go away? Come on, NBA. Let's go. Yeah. We need to make these things happen.
All right. Well, so now you've said the NBA is broken and needs to fix it and that all assistant coaches are lazy. I think that is enough Eclipse takes for today.
Former Ram, Patriot, and Eagle Chris Long joins Dave Dameshek on Minus Three, and he talks about the mindset of a veteran player chasing Lombardis.
How desperate are you to get the ring? Like, Raymond Bork is this Boston Bruins legend for all of time, only to Bobby Orr. But he was like, I really want a ring. And so he went to Colorado, went to Denver, Colorado to get it. It's like, how much?
I went to New England to get it. I mean, you know.
I mean, what? But did it feel like I would have been? I had to chase this one. I wish it would have been like
the Eagles. The team was the built Eagles around felt me. Like the, well, yeah, no, you don't feel that way. You just feel like when you were on, like I was on the Rams for a long time. People don't watch those games, so nobody knows. They don't know who you are. They have some notion of who you are, but they don't know who you are. And then you end up on a good team, and albeit you could play pretty good. Like I played pretty good in Philly, but I wasn't me. You know what I mean? I was older. So yeah, to answer the question, it'd be like, yeah, it'd be cool if I got to play on prime time a year where I was relatively dominant or something. You know, it's just like when you get there and you're old, you're kind of like, hey, world, you know me as 34-year-old guy who runs and it hurts. It looks like it hurts. You know what I mean? It looks. That's a sick joke. You know, it's kind of a sick joke. Like, here, we'll give you what you want, but you got to look like a shell of yourself. That's why it would be fun. But who I would add to Philly.
Well, but you went viral a couple months ago by talking about context matters in pro football. And of course, yes. This is what we talk about endlessly on this show is about that context. So it's super interesting to think about like that you're.
Well, if I was on a good team, like, I'd have been even better.
Well, like Ryan Tannehill, but, you know, guys like that, like, you know, and Roethlisberger and all big time QBs, when there's a younger guy who's brought in Aaron Rodgers and other, they always are like, I'm not here to teach. Like, that's got to be a wake up. I'm only 32 years old. But in the context of football, you're an old man now. It's like, hey, teach this guy how to do it. Like, man, I'm not done yet. I don't want to teach him how to replace me.
Yeah. Getting old in the NFL, and Russ is an example of this, where his whole career, he's been a star. And like, now he has to like feel what the other half lives like. You know, it's
in a weird way, it's an ego blow for people
massive
egos. Yeah,
it sucks. Well, we don't. We have normal, for the most part, you would hope, healthy, like normal. So you get like encouraged and you're like, you know, whatever. And then all of a sudden Russ is not only going through the thing he went through in Denver, but he thinks like, oh, they threw me a lifeboat. And he's doing a press conference. He's got the black sport coat and he's got a haircut and he's like, I'm Mr. Steeler. Like, and then 3 days later, they're like, hey, and we're trading for Justin Fields. And it's the reality of the NFL. Like the security when you're a great player is awesome, you know, but you earned it, but it's awesome, but you get used to it, you know? And although I was never like a great, great player, I was like team captain and, you know, like one of the guys. So, you know, when you change teams, there are some moments where you're like, damn, dude, this is what the NFL is like. It's and you really respect, you always respect undrafted free agents and you respected guys that had to really like come out of nowhere. But when you get to be older and they treat you that way a little bit more, it's eye opening. I'll just say that.
Oh man. I bet. And you know, again, context, lots of money and you're superhuman physically and all that kind of stuff. I think it does create a different level of ego and a different reality that you reside in versus
anybody would be affected the way that some guys get affected.
For sure.
Because you're only human.
Of course. And so you're susceptible to the treats that come along with being a multimillionaire who is a superhuman physically and handsome and all that kind of stuff. Of course that opens different doors for you
I just mean security as in like, you don't have to look over your shoulder to see if somebody's
exactly what you mean. Yeah. I get it, the other side.
And that's the way people think about it is like, oh, life's good. But if you really care about football, my life's way easier now. My life's way chiller now. Like, you spend every minute of the day paranoid. Even that's the way I'm wired. But I could imagine being Russell Wilson and going to the Hall of Fame and like that. Like, that's gonna be great. You can have your own office if you want your own office. So you like how far you fall when you're one of those superstars and late in your career, you got to kind of shovel a little bit. That can suck. Cause I know we joke a lot about Russ, but his belief, like he believes in himself. Like that's a big part of it. And right now he still does. The rest of the world could be like, hey, you're not as good. But in his head, he's got to think that way. And it's hard to turn that off.
And let's stop down for a quick break here.
Tired of ads interrupting your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts. Enjoy shows like First Take, Pardon the Interruption, and The Low Post, available ad-free and uninterrupted. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or go to amazon.com/ESPNpods. That's amazon.com/ESPNpods to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With the Masters underway at Augusta National, Brett Koromaos gives out some of his fantastic golf betting tips to Toby Mergler on Trendy.
You are a very successful golf bettor. And so now that we are heading into the Masters, and now that we are getting closer to like, what's the kind of like, let's just say it's the official start of golf season, right? Like you've got to be a sicko like you to really be paying attention before now. And we're no longer betting on the Zozo Open. We are playing like the most preeminent tournament there is. So I thought this would be a good opportunity for people that aren't as well invested into golf betting as they can or should be to learn a little bit about the way to research these bets. And so we did this with Jen with baseball last week. We're going to do it with golf with you right now. So when you sit down on a Monday to start thinking about how you're going to attack a big golf tournament over the weekend, where do you start?
Well, I would start by saying that as much as I love the hype, I would probably say I'm more a slightly above break even golf bettor, not a great one, but I've done okay. But I think the thing that I've enjoyed most about golf, and I've learned a lot and I've gotten better. So I'm hoping you're catching me on the upswing here. But the thing that I enjoy about golf too, is that there's a lot of fun. Like this is a Dave Damchek thing here. But there's a lot of fun bets because the thing is you can bet guys at like plus 900 throughout the year. And so you're taking these huge bets, but you can actually be profitable doing it. This isn't like when I go on Covered in Glory and I'm telling Toby, hey, yeah, this center back, take him at plus 900. That's probably a leak. That's a losing play. But in golf, that's actually the
It is a losing play.
It is a losing play. You're right. Yes. It's fun to do, but it's a losing play. In golf, though, the fun part about the betting is that because it's so hard to win a tournament and because there's so many tournaments and there's long odds, you tend to make plays kind of in the aggregate. Like if you're thinking a player might win a couple tournaments over the course of the year, like Scottie Scheffler is a perfect example. His odds have been insane. He's won two of, I think, his eight tournaments that he's played this year. But if you would have bet $100 on him every tournament at the odds that he even had to win those two that he won, you would be profitable right now. And so it's kind of an interesting thing. It's really like everything in golf would be like our heater category and how you want to bet it. You're betting trends. You're betting guys that are playing well. You know, really successful golf bettors like Rufus Peabody, who does ETR's projections. You know, they have Data Golf, who really gets a lot of credit for projecting cut lines and things like that. They root themselves a lot in really long-term baselines, 100 rounds, 200 rounds, a golfer kind of performing to a long-term baseline. But there's also a lot of data scientists that work with golf that say the last 36 rounds are very correlative to predictive performance. So how a guy is playing more recently matters. I am more moving to that camp. I think it's kind of colored by the fact that I wasn't very good, but I did play in high school, that in my playing experience, I can tell you that how I was playing 2 years before previous didn't really affect me all that much. You get in grooves. Anybody who's played casually or even like, you know, semi-seriously as a hobby, you get in grooves. And I think players do that. They're ball striking. They find something in their swing and they play. So I'm a pretty big recent form guy. You know, if the guy's showing me something, whether it's driving accuracy with using strokes gain data, driving accuracy, driving distance has changed. His play around the green has changed. His ball striking and approach has changed. He's gaining strokes off the tee. I'm looking for something. I'm usually trying to match that up with the news, right? So if a guy says, oh, I changed my putter before round X, and then all of a sudden his strokes gain putting takes a big jump, then I love that matchup. I love seeing those two things coincide because a lot of athletes are like, oh, I, you know, started, you know, even basketball players, I moved my finger a little bit on the ball and now I'm shooting threes better. And then you look at his like recent 3-point shooting and he's like shooting like 30%. And you're like, that's just you telling yourself something.
Everything you're saying makes sense to me. And like, you know, I didn't play in high school. I barely play at all. And for me, like the two shots earlier is not going to be indicative of where the ball might go the next time. Cause it could go either on the green or into the actual clubhouse. You never know. But golf's a little bit different in terms of like course factors, right? Like every basketball court is the same dimensions. Football is the same dimensions. Baseball varies a little bit, but not so wildly as golf. And so like, does course factors come that much into your analysis? Is that something that you just look, you know, you're more looking at the 36 round trends?
Yeah, it's definitely, that was the next stop. You are, Toby, pick up so fast in these things. You're gonna be a better golf better than me before the end of this.
Says I'm not already.
Yeah, that's true. You probably are. But course factor is huge. Every course offers different and unique challenges. Augusta National, we'll get into a little bit as we talk about that actual thing. But some courses are way, way more inclined to just bombers who spray it. Other courses that maybe have a lot of water on certain holes are going to be more inclined to players that can avoid, you know, putting it in the water off their drive. Some courses are going to be lower scoring affairs where bogey avoidance is more important than making birdies. Other tournaments are going to be one at 20 under. Some tournaments that you're going to need great around the green play. Other times it's not going to matter because the green complexes aren't as complex. And so guys like Rick Remga does a great job of doing data analysis that do correlated, kind of skill sets to each course. So which courses need more driving distance? Which courses need more accuracy? Which courses does approach play show that it matters more? So course fit is huge. That is definitely where you kind of like good players are going to pretty much play well everywhere. Like Scottie Scheffler, there isn't a course right now where Scottie, the Tiger Woods 2.0, isn't going to play well. Most of the top 10 guys are going to play well pretty much anywhere. But betting guys that have, you know, kind of more specific skill sets, guys that are maybe just really good approach players or guys that are just maybe really accurate off the tee, how the course fits those types of players, they'll do really well on some courses and they'll do really poorly on others. And then there also are guys that are course horses. And those are guys that just play well at a course. Like last week, I made some DFS plays on Kevin Streelman, who has missed two out of like his eight cuts this year. But at the Valero, this dude just top 40s. Over the last 10 years, this dude just top 40s. Doesn't matter his form coming in. And I've had that. That's something that relates to my experience, or maybe casual players are like, oh yeah, I have that course that I just play well at.
If you're paying full price to go to a game, should you be able to boo the players on your favorite team? Dave Damashek and Sarah Tiana debate this during a brand new Extra Points.
Local hero, David Bednar, Pittsburgh, PA native, an all-star closer in the past, having some awful struggles early going for the otherwise very successful Pittsburgh Pirates, soaring high, but Bednar has blown three saves. In Pittsburgh, he blew a save to the Detroit Tigers the other day, and some people in attendance booed. This led Rowdy Tellez, new member of the Buccos, to flack for Bednar before the press could even get to Bednar and say, like, the fans have to be better. You can't boo him like this. This was wrong to do this. How say you, Sarah Tiana, on the locals in Pittsburgh booing native son David Bednar? Is that out of bounds, or are you a paying customer? You're allowed to do whatever you want to do.
Yeah, I think I'm a paying customer, and it shows that I'm a passionate fan, and I'm probably going to boo the other team just like faster. But you're frustrated. You want to win. You're on a roll. You start off super hot. You got this great team around you, a young team. You know, a lot of prospects coming through the pipeline. Like, you know, I feel like everybody kind of looks at the Pirates as this like major league team, right? That you're the Cleveland Indians because, you know,
some people don't regard them as a major league team with good reason.
Well, I mean, from the movie Major League, right? So I'm just saying you know.
Oh, I see.
Like Major League-esque in that, like, you know, you're the little engine that could, you know, you're not the highest payroll. You're not even the half highest payroll, you know, but like still so good. So many good prospects, so many so many possibilities. And especially at the beginning of the season, you're like, wow, we could do it. We could, you know, we could go places in this division, because the division itself isn't insane. You know, you're beating the Reds, so it seems, you who are also a fun team. So I think people are frustrated that you want to start off hot. You want to keep the momentum, and every game does matter. I mean, we talked about it with the Phillies and the Rangers just getting home field advantage based on the first series of the season last year. And when you are a Philadelphia team, losing home field advantage would have been a really big deal since Philly is so good. So I don't disagree, but I love Tellez coming to bat for him. Like, I think that shows unity within the team. And I think it's ultimately great. Like, you do need adversity and you do need people booing you so that you're not let off the hook. I don't think he's probably pretty aware that he's blowing the save, and you're not going to, like, booing him doesn't change the fact that he's already mad at himself. Like, it doesn't.
Is Atlanta a booing town? I don't associate. I feel like the sports fan experience there is that if the team is bad, people just don't go to the games. It's not that they go there, that they're so white hot with rage or whatever. It's just like, well, screw them then. God, well, bless their hearts. I hope they turn it around by next season is sort of the reaction that I sense from the South.
No, we're definitely a booing team when it comes to certain teams, like the Phillies, the Mets. The Mets are in town right now.
I mean booing your own.
No, we don't really boo our own. But the stadium, you know, we had the most sellouts of any team in Major League Baseball last year. Like, people are really going. Especially the new stadium is pretty amazing. And the Battery, which is like kind of the new method that people are, when they're building new stadiums, they're building the experience around the stadium, which is, you don't have to go into the game to be there and enjoy it. So even if you can't get into the game, or maybe you don't want to buy a ticket, you just come, park, sit at the restaurants, drink beer, watch the game. They have all these big screens and like big play areas for kids, big turf grass areas, bands playing, you know, the broadcasters sit out there so you can even be a part of the broadcast. Like, there's stores, and all the stores have to do with baseball. Like, there's a baseballism store. There's all these cool, trendy merchandise stores of like eclectic merchandise that you could never get in the stadium. But they're like,
they were to do that at Dodger Stadium. Remember that about a decade ago? They were thinking about building out in the parking lot, a whole thing. And then the cynics were like, we shouldn't have to try to lure people with other stuff to come and watch baseball. But,
Now with Dodger Stadium, the big thing is the what is that thing called? Like, the gondola. They're trying to build a gondola from downtown LA to Chavez Ravine so that people can get to the stadium. It's such a traffic nightmare getting in and out of there. Although I feel like they've kind of figured it out. It's not as bad as SoFi, but yeah. So I think the Braves, I don't think Braves fans boo their own players that much. Like, I can even remember when I worked there, like, Mark Wohlers was really struggling as a reliever, and people would like just cheer him, even if he was like blowing state, like, people would just give him standing ovations when he came in. And it almost messed him up because it put more pressure on him to feel like, oh, everybody loves me so much. If they hate
wait
you,
am I supposed
like,
to be throwing home run balls, maybe that's what they seem to like. I guess I'll throw another one.
You know how, like, sometimes that can backfire? Like, it didn't backfire with Trey Turner last year when they gave him the standing ovation. And I know that Angels just tried to do that for Rendon, but sometimes it can backfire. Like, sometimes you do need that adversity of people booing you and hating you to be like, I'll prove you wrong. It just depends on where you are in your mental space of like what you can handle and what you can't.
I think that's right. You always hear about the most successful coaches and managers are the ones who understand that, you can't treat every player the same, you know, carrot or the whip and all that kind of stuff. The Pittsburgh fans booing a local guy is gross to me. It veers into Philly and Boston and New York territory. Mm-hmm. I ain't for it. But as I've said before, and we'll say again, once the locals start going to hockey games and doing chants to fire the football team's offensive coordinator, the horse has left the barn and there's no coming back, from it at this point. I mean, like, that's, I guess Pittsburgh is veering into ugly sports town status now, where that kind of stuff goes.
Yeah. On. I applaud the passion. Like, I'm a big fan of that. I was a fan of the Steelers fans cheering for Matt Canada to leave. I think what I don't like is when your team is good and successful and you're booing one thing, where you're like, all right, no, like, I'm sorry, but Chiefs fans don't get to boo one ref not getting a call. You know what I mean? Like, no, now you're just, that's a like loser. Like, that's like a what I'm trying to say, like, you have it all mentality, and like, you still want more. It's like the eat the rich.
Want to have his cake and some pie. Right?
Yeah.